Hello, and welcome to episode 29 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. We're here today with Sebastian Johnson, former candidate for Montgomery County Board of Education and former student member of the Board of Education for Montgomery County. How are you doing today, Sebastian?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me on.
Glad to have you. So the first question I'd like to ask you is, what are you currently doing or what have you ever done to advance the public interest and why?
Well, so in my current day job, I work as a consultant to corporate philanthropies, nonprofits, and foundations. And so what I see my role as is helping people who want to do good in the world figure out what policy solutions there are to advance their missions, mm-hmm. how to communicate that mission, how to improve their organization so that they're increasing their impact. Mm-hmm. And that's what I try to do in my day-to-day. This is actually the first time I worked for a private company. All of my other employers have been public service organizations, organizations that are promoting policies to improve people's lives.
Mm-hmm. So how do you find the different, how would you compare and contrast working in the private sector as opposed to working for a government mm-hmm. Agency in relation to advancing the public interest, doing public service?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's interesting on this side because, you know, there is a client relationship. So that's, you know, it's a little different from working, you know, when I was a teacher, mm-hmm. you know, we thought of our students as, you know, it's not really a client, like make the client happy. You're
right.
There to advance education for the kids. Mm-hmm. So adjusting to having a client relationship and figuring out, you know, how do we do the most good, but also how do we keep our client happy mm-hmm. is a different approach. Mm-hmm. Things work a lot quicker in the private sector in terms of, although, you know, you'd be surprised, you know, a lot of foundations have some of the similar problems that, you know, you hear about from governments where there being a lot of bureaucracy or
right.
a lot of regulation. But, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting difference between the private and public sector.
So you mentioned that you were a teacher.
Yes.
So how did you get into that?
I joined Teach for America out of undergrad in 2010 mm-hmm. And joined the Boston Teach for America Corps.
Okay.
And taught third grade in Lawrence, Massachusetts.
Huh. Mm-hmm. How did you, so you, and so you had in, you went to high school in Montgomery County.
Yep.
And, mm-hmm. At Blair?
Yeah. I graduated from Blair in 2006.
Okay.
Went to Georgetown and got my undergraduate degree and mm-hmm. then did Teach for America right after.
So why, mm-hmm. what motivated you to do Teach for America?
When I went to undergrad, I initially wanted to be a teacher. Mm-hmm. I wanted to study education, but they don't actually offer that major at Georgetown, so that was a fail in on my part. It was like, oh, well, they don't actually offer the thing you want to study. Yeah. So I decided to do economics and government instead, mm-hmm. But still really wanted to have classroom experience. My goal was always to be a high school history teacher because I just loved history, you know, all through high school and middle school. Uh-huh. But ended up being dealt the elementary school hand and still loved it.
So you sign up for TFA and you just get put in a place and told which subject and what grade you're going to be teaching.
Yes. So you can rank. And so I think I ranked high school first and mm-hmm. then elementary school and then middle school. And they tried to give you your first.
And you got your placement. Last choice.
Well, I got my middle choice. I was like, definitely not middle school.
Okay.
No, you know, props all of the great middle school teachers out there. Both my roommates. Or one of my roommates, when I was in Teach America, actually taught middle school and loved it.
Huh.
One roommate taught high school, one roommate taught middle school, and I taught elementary school. So we saw the entire gamut of education just in our little house in Boston.
Interesting. So you got, how did you get placed in Boston?
You also rank your placements. I knew I wanted to go somewhere different mm-hmm. after college, just because
you grew up here.
Yeah,
Georgetown is here. You would spend your whole life in the DC area.
Exactly. Okay. And so I wanted a different experience, and so I ranked some cities that I was interested in living in.
Yeah.
Honestly, and ended up in Boston. Boston's it's a great town. I'm happy to be here now because right now it's very cold there.
Yeah.
So I'm happy, you know, for the 80 degree October weather instead of the blizzard.
So you were a teacher up there for mm-hmm. a few years, teaching third grade.
Uh huh.
And how did you find that experience in terms of, I mean, was it, so you had had, so just for our listeners to know, a student member of the board in Montgomery County, there's a board of education, which basically spends the $2.3 billion of the Montgomery County Public School budget, which is appropriated by the Montgomery County Council. And one of the members, so most of the members, all but one of the members are directly elected by the electorate. And then one member is actually a student member of the board, which means that individual is a senior in high school in MCPS. So that's what Sebastian was. So he was involved with the Board of Education as a student in high school, went to college, and then he started teaching in Boston. So having had that background on the budget with Montgomery County in a very large school district, and it sounds like you, I imagine it was a smaller school district.
Yes. So, you know, the town of Lawrence is absolutely the smallest school district, but I also, I was, the school I taught at is a charter school.
Okay.
It was one of the, I think the first charter schools in Massachusetts was founded by the Community Group, which was a local nonprofit there in the 70s.
Yeah.
They founded it, I think, in the 90s. So that was a huge difference in terms of, you know, looking at a school district and understanding the needs of different students and figuring that out, to going to a school that I think there was 300 kids K through eight, and there was only 2 third grade classrooms. So it was a huge difference. It did make me certainly appreciate the resources we have here in Montgomery County. And yeah, that, that was kind of the striking difference, is that, you know, it was a very old school. It's, it was a convent school in the 50s, and then they refurbished it and turned it into a school, but it was a very old building. There's lots of poverty. And so that, that I think was,
where is it geographically?
Lawrence, Massachusetts is 40 miles north of Boston. So it's up near the New Hampshire border on the Merrimack River. Lawrence is actually is one of the first mill towns in the United States. The Lowell family and a number of the other prominent Boston families started textile mills on the Merrimack River. So Lowell and Lawrence are kind of sister cities there, and have obviously been hit very hard by the loss of manufacturing and the loss of jobs. But yeah, it's a beautiful community. I love teaching. I love my coworkers.
The kids
were amazing.
So. So you did policy as a student member of the board, and then you became a teacher. I guess how, and then you ran to be a full member of the board again. So in your candidacy, to be a full member of the Board of Education, how did you, obviously you had teaching experience under your belt. So, whereas previously you hadn't when you were a student. So how did that teaching experience change your viewpoint about how to enact the responsibilities of a member of the Board of Education from when you had previously sat on it?
I think as a student member, you bring, you know, your perspective as a student. I think that's why they have the position. That's why it's valuable. You're seeing the impact of policies every day in the classroom. As a teacher, I think you have a different perspective on, definitely on like curriculum and instruction. I learned that, you know, all of the best intended policies, you know, they're not going to work if you don't have teachers who are behind it, if you don't have teachers who understand how to do what you're asking them to do, if you don't give your teachers the resources they need to get the outcomes that you want. And so I think that just having the experience of, all right, well, we have a state test, we have a curriculum, but it really is up to you as the adult in the classroom to make it happen for those kids every day. That experience, I think, was really valuable. And having that perspective also, it gives you some understanding of like, well, it allows you to ask the question, like, what is this going to mean in the classroom? You know, it takes it away from, you know, what curriculum is the hot new curriculum, or what policy is going to please XYZ factions or stakeholders in the public. And you think, you know, what impact is this going to have in the classroom?
So there are many different policies, for instance, Common Core or Parks testing, or all kinds of different, you know, different start times and different, you know, there's many different, I guess, I'm not sure if they're fads or trends or new developments, we could say, in educational policy and curriculums. I guess, you know, where, How did you see any of those implemented as a teacher?
Yeah. My second year teaching was the year that we were preparing for the adoption of Common Core. So I did see, you know, what changes were going to be made and how those changes were going to impact, you know, when you think about third grade math curriculum, you have new standards that are mm-hmm. asking you to do different things. How is that going to impact, mm-hmm. you know, the state test? You know, how are we going to fit this into, you know, the year? I mean, that's always the constraint is time for teachers.
So are students expected, I don't know, maybe age 8 in third grade, are they expected to do different things now than you were expected to do as a student when you were in third grade?
I would say absolutely.
For the better? Are we expecting more or just different?
I think we're expecting more kids. And I think that, you know, high expectations are always good. Mm-hmm. You want to raise your expectations and raise your standards, and the kids meet those standards, and I think that that's appropriate. Some of it I don't think has been developmentally appropriate. So, for instance, I can give you an example of one of the Common Core standards for third grade math. Mm-hmm. There's one. So in third grade, you mm-hmm. learn area and perimeter. Like, you actually learn what those concepts are in your geometry unit.
Okay.
And this standard said that not only will students be able to find the area and perimeter of a rectangle, mm-hmm. they'll also be able to, if you give them three sides of a rectangle, mm-hmm. or like one side and then a question mark, mm-hmm. they should be able to backwards solve mm-hmm. for that variable, which is algebra. So, yeah. And it's not that third graders can't do algebra. We were able to get our third graders to understand some pretty advanced concepts. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, you don't use the variable X, you use maybe a question mark or a box, and you mm-hmm. show them how order of operations works. Mm-hmm. But to me, it seems like we're rushing to pack all of these concepts in. Mm-hmm. And the kids who get it, it's great for them. But the kids who really don't get it, if you really struggle with the first part of that, mm-hmm. the area and perimeter, then mm-hmm. you're going to be lost.
Yeah.
And so I do think we need to figure out how do we actually scaffold a lot of these standards so that we're not losing kids and we're not, you know, taking some of the fun out of teaching, to be honest. It's important that kids enjoy school as well as that they meet academic standards, I think.
So what should be the purpose of public education?
That's a good question. I think it has to serve a couple of purposes. I think that you want to produce good citizens. I think that was something that was really important to me. I was responsible for teaching social studies, and I wanted to make sure that my students had a good sense of their history and a good sense of their community and rules and why we have them and why we follow them. Mm-hmm. So I think that's really important. But you also, you know, education is our metric or our way of providing social mobility. So I do think that there's an economic purpose as well. And often the people who need, you know, the most education or they need the most help in order to be socially mobile aren't getting it. And that is something that really motivates me to be involved in public education.
Do you think there's still a strong correlation between educational attainment and socioeconomic success?
I absolutely do. I think that link is weakening a little because
if you look at millennials and you look at the not the achievement gap, which mm-hmm. that's its own thing, mm-hmm. but the socioeconomic disparities across all races and demographics mm-hmm. in the United States, it's widening. In fact, around the world. So absolutely. Increasingly you have even, you know, millennials who've graduated from the best public schools, gone to the best universities, mm-hmm. and then find themselves as baristas post-college.
Right.
So, you know, how do you reconcile the increasing difficulty of top graduates mm-hmm. to succeed in our new economy with the idea that education leads to material success in the world?
Right. And I do think that, you know, if you look on the whole, you know, college graduates out-earn over their lifetimes people who have an associate's degree or people who only have a high school degree. Mm-hmm. So I think that the best way that we know how to provide social mobility is still through education. I do agree with you that the link between, you know, getting a bachelor's degree is no longer, you know, congratulations, here's your ticket to the easy life.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we're going to increasingly start to see that the jobs that we once thought were good jobs, you know, just as we've seen a lot of blue collar jobs disappear,
mm-hmm.
we're going to start to see white collar jobs disappear as automation and computing power replace those jobs. You know, if you're an accountant, there's going to be a software that can do that job better than you.
Mm-hmm.
I think even for radiologists, there's some software that can like find it. So it's kind of like, well, you know, you spend all this time, you know, getting your radiology degree.
I'm like 35 years old before I finished medical school and residency and become a radiologist. And now I'm ready to make my $400,000 a year.
Yep.
And oops, I'm unemployed.
Exactly. And so I do think that, you know, so one of the things I've been involved with recently is the idea of a basic income,
mm-hmm.
Providing every American enough money to make sure that everyone is above the poverty line. And I do think we need to think strategically and critically about the new economy and what kind of upgrades we'll have to make to our social compact in order to make that economy work for everyone. But I think you're right. The fact that people are saddled with a lot of college debt,
mm-hmm.
and that their degree is no guarantee of a good job, mm-hmm. is a really challenging aspect of being a young person in society today.
So you lived up in Massachusetts for a while, and that's where you taught, mm-hmm. and you formed relationships with the educational community up there.
Mm-hmm.
But then you returned to Montgomery County,
mm-hmm.
to run for Board of Education. What is it about this district,
mm-hmm.
this school district, this county, this population, this location that drew you back here, that made you want to run for a Board of Education here, especially in light of the things you just spoke about, like a universal minimum income level? That's something that would more happen in the state legislature.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
why run for the particular office of Board of Education on the one hand, and on the other hand, why not do it where you were, where it would have been probably much easier in a smaller district than Massachusetts where you already were a teacher?
Mm-hmm.
Why return to do it here? What's special about MCPS?
Well, I mean, Montgomery County is just home. I grew up here. My family's here. All my friends who I am still friends with, we all went to school together here and we mm-hmm. live in the area. And mm-hmm. so after 4 years in Massachusetts, I taught and then I got my master's degree at the Kennedy School. After 4 years, I was done with Boston winters and wanted to be home. And the reason that I ran for school board, I think there's, you know, anyone who's running for public office or considering it should ask themselves three questions before they run.
Mm-hmm.
Is the job you're running for, like, are you should you have the job? Mm-hmm. So is there no one else who can do it? Do you think that you could do the job in a particular way? So that's the first thing. Second, like, what are the reasons that you're running for? Like, what are the things that you want to work on once you get on in whatever the position is? Like, what are your issues?
Mm-hmm.
And third, like, are you willing to sacrifice your time and energy? Like, do you think that is worth the sacrifice of time and effort? And so I ran for the school board because I thought that I could justify to myself on those three criteria that I knew a lot about education policy. I'd been an education policy analyst for Governor O'Malley.
Mm-hmm.
I had taught, I had gotten a policy. So I understood the substance of what we were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I had really definite ideas about ways that I thought that I could improve Montgomery County, doubling down on bilingual education, making smart strategic investments in pre-kindergarten,
mm-hmm.
continuing to make sure that we are closing the achievement gap by addressing the disparities in classrooms. And so I thought that that was a platform that I really cared about and would want to work on.
Mm-hmm.
And it was worth the sacrifice to me.
What did you sacrifice?
Just a lot of time. There were a lot of 12-hour days. I was working as a policy analyst at the Institute on Taxation Economic Policy. Missed a lot of work. Just driving around the county and making sure that you're in front of voters. And, you know, because people, you know, I jumped into the race in January, no one knew who I was or...
For an April election.
For an April election, right.
So a four-month...
Yeah. 4 months...
Campaign.
Yeah, so it was very short,
mm-hmm.
campaign, and so it was just a lot of work to start from zero and get to where we ended up, which was, you know, of course, not where we wanted to end up, but, mm-hmm. you know, even just in 4 months, it was a lot to get to where we ended. So that's why I decided to run for school board. I thought that I had something of value to offer the community. I thought that we needed a younger voice on the board.
What does a younger voice bring?
I think, so from my perspective, I would bring the voice of someone who is a recent graduate of the schools, mm-hmm. who, so, yeah, it's been 10 years, so we'll be celebrating our 10-year anniversary soon, but in recent enough memory that it's like, I remember what it's like to be a student, mm-hmm. I remember what it was like to be in class and how it operated. I had experience as a previous board member, mm-hmm. as a student board member, but I'm also... you know, someone who's out in the job market, who is dealing with the economy and understanding what it's going to take for one of our students to graduate yeah. and get a job.
Yeah. Because you had recently dealt with that yourself yeah. on a personal level.
Yep. And so I think that a diversity of voices and opinions is always valuable for, you know, any group. You know, they've done studies of businesses and they've shown that diverse teams create more, they generate more profit, they drive new ideas. And so I think that's an important thing to have on, particularly on the Board of Education, where you're making policy that's going to be baked in sometimes for generations.
So we're nearing the end of the podcast. I'd mm-hmm. like to ask two more questions.
Sure.
You had mentioned your three metrics that mm-hmm. would determine whether you would run for office.
Uh-huh.
The first was, are you the right person for the job? Are you better than the competition?
Uh-huh.
The second was, are you knowledgeable? What are the policy issues you're running on?
Right.
And the third was, are you willing to make the sacrifices?
Mm-hmm.
How did you come to those metrics? How did those become your metrics?
You know, I'll be honest with you. I don't know if I had those metrics at the outset. You know, kind of had a feeling, was like, I think this is the right thing to do. And then in responding, when people ask, you know, why are you doing this? Having to think about, like, you know, what are my reasons for doing it? That's kind of how I came to those three metrics.
Is it ever appropriate for question two?
Mm-hmm.
Is it ever appropriate in response to why are you doing this? Instead of saying pre-K or foreign language immersion or achievement gap, which are policy areas, and those are mm-hmm. those are great. Is it ever appropriate to say, well, I believe in public service. This is kind of an excellent avenue where I know I'm well positioned to do a lot. I have experience previously on this board. Mm-hmm. I've done it professionally. I have a graduate degree. I've been a teacher. I'm well prepared. But more than anything, for me, it's about dedicating my life to public service and being an elected official in this capacity mm-hmm. that gave so much to me could be a good place to start. So yes, policy issues are there. But is it ever appropriate to say, well, you know, public service is an appropriate motivation for me that really drives me?
I think public service is absolutely a motivation and is a noble one. For me, I would want to be in a position if I didn't have a policy agenda that I wanted to work toward.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got asked two questions often when I... by voters. Mm-hmm. So the first one is, you know, number one, are you old enough to run for the school board? That was always the first one. It's like, how old are you? Can you actually run for this office?
And for our listeners who cannot see Sebastian's face, Sebastian, please tell us how old you think people think you are?
I think people thought that I was 15 or 16.
And how old are you?
I'm 28.
And how old were you on election day?
I was 27 on election day.
So you're 27, and you said people thought you looked almost a decade younger.
Right. And when I would say, oh, you know, I was a student member on the board, when they say, well, adults can't vote for the student member, so why are you asking? I'm like, no. It's like, you missed the point. So that was kind of the first one. Uh-huh. And then the second one was, you know, well, are you just running for this as a stepping stone? Like, are you going to, you know, leave in a year or two just to run for something else?
Hmm.
Why
would they ask that of you? Do you think they ask that of other elected officials?
I don't know. I think youth is a part of it. I think there is I wouldn't say it's a bias, but you know, there's a little bit more doubt when people see a young person trying to do something, like, why are you doing it? I think that people understand, like, you know, if you are a retired principal or a retired teacher and you want to serve in school, people are like, oh, I understand that. Like, mm-hmm. you've done it. You had the experience. Like, you, like, there, people have an idea of what a school board member should look like in their head. So I think for me, the reason that I want to have the agenda is to say, in the time that you're electing me to, these are the things that I want to, like, make significant progress on or try to accomplish. Mm-hmm. Because I don't, because while it's public service is a noble goal, like, you should have some way to measure your success as a member, right? As a member of a legislature or as a member of a board. Mm-hmm. There should be some policy. Like, you're not just there to serve the public. You're there to make specific changes that you ran on.
Right.
So for me, if I'm like, well, I don't really have any specific changes, and I like the, I think the guy in the position is doing a fine job, I just don't understand why I would run.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I think that anyone who wants to put themselves out there in public life, like, believes in public service and should and hold that value.
So, and a last question is, if you would take a moment and reflect upon all that you've given, you know, and why. You know, you've given a lot. You mentioned, at least for those 4 months, you worked very hard. Why? Why do it? You know, surely someone else will do it. Maybe they won't be as good as you, according to you. But, you know, there'll always be someone there.
Right.
So why give so much? And, you know, there would always, if you hadn't taught in Massachusetts, they probably would have found a teacher eventually for that. So why is it that you have chosen to take this path of public service?
You know, for me, it's important to give and to do things for others because other people have done so much for me. And I think that, you know, service is kind of the, it's the debt that you owe in your life because others have done things, you know, particularly in public policy to serve you and to make sure that you have the tools that you need to be successful. You know, none of us is doing any of the things that we do on our own. And so for me, what really motivates me is the idea that if I have any talents or abilities, because people have done service for me. And so I am obligated, therefore, to use my talents and abilities to serve others. That's just my philosophy on it.
So that has been Sebastian Johnson, who speaks about his already over a decade of dedication to public service as something that's incumbent upon him, who has received so much in his life from the public that he feels responsible to his community. And he attributes a great deal of his personal success to contributions from others and from society. Someone who believes in certain policy issues and has worked to gain that expertise, and also somebody who believes in public service as a worthwhile goal in its own right. This has been episode 29 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll talk to you next time.